loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Saudi Air Force yesterday bombed a wedding in Yemen, killing at least 20 people and wounding more than 45. Most of the dead were women and children, including the bride. A family of five was killed on Saturday, and 20 more people were killed on Friday. The Saudis have adopted a U.S. tactic of bombing weddings and funerals to inflict the most damage possible. Meanwhile, in Yemen, a top leader of the Houthi rebels, which control the country's north, has been confirmed killed in a separate raid. Next, at least 10 people were killed during demonstrations in Nicaragua this weekend over the issue of pension reforms, amidst criticisms of the country's economy raised by the International Monetary Fund. Is a progressive government like Nicaragua's bending to IMF pressure? Then, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then CIA Director Michael Pompeo's nomination to be Secretary of State will come to a vote this afternoon in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He will likely not receive a favorable vote, but he still has a path to victory on the floor of the Senate. And finally, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign was cut short 50 years ago with his assassination, but a new effort aims to carry on his legacy. To assist that campaign, the Institute for Policy Studies has produced a 123-page report on the state of poverty in America to provide facts and data for the movement. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. The Saudi Air Force yesterday bombed a wedding in Yemen, killing 20 people and wounding 45. Most of the dead were women and children, including the bride. This is the third Saudi bombing in Yemen in the past 3 days. A family of five was killed on Saturday, and 20 more people were killed on Friday. The Saudis have adopted a U.S. tactic of bombing weddings and funerals to inflict the most possible damage. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's a legendary activist and co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Medea, I hate that we have to have these kinds of conversations practically every time you come on to talk to us. Can things get any worse in Yemen? And why is it, and this is not a rhetorical question, why is it that the international community is not up in arms over these murders, which is really what they are?
Well, right. You'd think that everybody who met with the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia, when he was doing his 3-week tour of all the elites in the United States, would now be regretting having gone to the gala dinners with him, and may be doing something even more, like asking him why are they killing people at wedding parties or residential neighborhoods or a commuter bus like they did this weekend. But I don't see much of an outcry by, in fact, I don't see any outcry by any of the people that he met with.
No, not a word, actually. And I took the time to go through the press today and see if anybody who publicly met with Mohammed bin Salman during his, whatever it was, 9 or 10 day trip to the United States had anything at all to say about Yemen. And nobody did. Nobody did. I saw one press piece saying that a Houthi official was killed in an air raid last week. But nobody, Medea, is saying that these raids were meant to kill Houthi officials, that they were meant to decapitate the Yemeni military leadership. These were just plain and simple attacks on civilians, which seems to me to be the definition of a war crime. But nobody is really saying anything.
Well, let's remember that the targeting of funerals and weddings is something that started before this Saudis got involved. It was U.S. drone strikes. In fact, in 2013, a U.S. drone strike hit a wedding party. In 2015, they hit another wedding party. That was once the Saudis got involved. But the U.S. hit funerals and weddings, and then helping the Saudis with their targeting are doing the same thing. And it was really when the October 2016 funeral that was hit by the Saudi bombings and killed 140 people, that was when President Obama started considering whether we should pull back a little bit in our support for the Saudis. But since Trump came in and it's all out for the Saudis, there's no questioning of these. And certainly when you look at a weekend of mayhem that they wreaked upon the people of Yemen, with the bride being killed, mostly women and children dead and wounded, the groom with shrapnel scattered all over his body, some of the children missing limbs and eyes, there would be more questioning. You know, it should even be the people in Congress, of course, and there have been votes that have come very close to questioning the support for the Saudis, but I haven't even seen today Congress people speaking out about the three targets this weekend that were all resulted in civilian death.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And to your point a moment ago, the United States has been bombing weddings and funerals for years in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, mostly with the use of drones. And there really has been no public outcry. Now, I can tell you that several different times that these bombings took place, the United States came out and said very quietly, well, this was a mistake. We were looking for a tall Arab with wearing white with a long beard. Of course, they were talking about Osama bin Laden. They never got Osama bin Laden that day, but they killed an awful lot of innocent people. And then they'd apologize and throw some money around, and nobody really seemed to care. Well, when the rest of the international community sees that the United States can bomb weddings and funerals with impunity and nobody really cares and nobody complains and no charges are filed against anybody, they conclude rightfully that they can do the same exact thing and get away with it. And the next thing you know, you have an international policy of aggression where you are free to bomb and kill civilians and nobody's going to say anything about it. So where do people like us then go? Is there any way that we can force this issue into the press and can somehow push for change? Do you think it's even possible?
Well, first I wanted to add to something that you said about the U.S. throwing money around. What the U.S. tends to do is never apologize, but throw money around and think that that's going to do. In fact, that wedding party that they attacked in 2013, about a year later, they had given out almost about $1 million in compensation to the different parties, but it made people on the ground even madder because of the way they did it and because they never apologized. And we met people when we traveled to Yemen, and they all said the same thing. The U.S. refuses to apologize for what it did and then tries to buy us off with some money that we have to fight with them about, and then they haggle what's the price of our loved one, and it's all very ugly. And, of course, when you say nobody cares, I don't think you meant the local people.
No, certainly not. I mean Western governments.
Yeah, and it turns people in the whole region against. I mean, don't think that any time they hit a wedding party and 10 or 15 or 20 people die, that's the end of it. That means the entire region and the tribe that the wedding couple was part of are then turned against the United States. And they might go ahead and join Al-Qaeda, or these days they might join something like ISIS just as a way to try to get back at the United States.
Well, you are 100% correct on that. I can tell you, I have been responsible for the capture of dozens of Al-Qaeda fighters during my CIA career. And to a man, every single one of them said that they had no personal problem with the United States until we bombed their village and killed their sister and killed their grandfather and killed their cousin and blew up the whole village and bombed the mosque, et cetera, et cetera. And then they have no alternative than to take up arms against the United States. These drone strikes and these fighter jet strikes that result in these horrible, terrible civilian casualties do nothing but to breed terrorism. That's been a documented fact for many years, and it's something that our government and other Western governments, and I'm including the Saudis in that, have just refused to acknowledge.
Well, I know you have a firsthand experience with this, and in terms of what people can do, you know, we did come close in the Senate in a vote to stop supporting the Saudis, and we have to just revive that again. And we at Code Pink, if anybody's interested, they can sign up for alerts on our site, and we are pushing right now that in both the House and the Senate, they bring up those bills, and we're using these three attacks that happened over the weekend as another example of how The Saudis have not reformed their ways. They continue to attack civilians, and we continue to be hurt by our association with them. So, yes, we've got to stop the sale of weapons and stop the logistical support to the Saudis.
Medea, there's a Reuters report that came out just a few minutes ago, literally 2 minutes ago, and we're recording this at 1:45 p.m., saying that the administrative chief of Houthi-controlled northern Yemen was killed in this coalition air raid. Have you heard anything about that? Are the Saudis actually succeeding in any way in killing senior Houthi officials or in causing problems for the Houthi leadership in this campaign?
Well, if it's true, I mean, in other words, if they're bombing wedding parties as part of a decapitation strategy against the Houthis. Anyway, we don't know, but it could be important news. Go ahead, Medea.
Well, yes, if it's true, it is the most senior Houthi official to be killed by the coalition since it began the intervention in Yemen civil war in 2015. And the coalition had offered a $20 million reward for information that would lead to his capture. This is Samad. And they have been trying to get him and other leaders of the Houthis in the last 3 years. But indeed, this would be a major blow to the Houthis.
Yeah, this would be a major blow to the Houthis. Reuters is reporting that this is the number two Houthi political official. So if this news is true, this would be a very serious blow. With that said,
and also, John, just out of curiosity, both for you and Medea, I know we're running out of time. Might this not have then been coordinated with the CIA or with the Pentagon because they've been coordinating the targeting? Go ahead, Medea, or John, if you were going to jump in there.
You know what? My guess would be a strong yes, because you can't fly combat missions where you have multiple countries participating in combat missions without international coordination, especially with the largest military in the entire region. So I would say yes. Medea, I'd love to hear what you have to think.
Well, I would just say that whether it's Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, we've seen in the past when the U.S. has targeted the top leadership, it just brings another person from below up to the higher level, and oftentimes with more hatred against the Saudis or the United States, and it doesn't stop the continuation of the conflict. So yes, it will be a blow to the Houthis, but I'm sure there's someone else ready to take that position.
Without a doubt. And we saw the same thing happen both in Al-Qaeda and in ISIS. We're going to have to end it right there. That was the voice of Medea Benjamin, who joined us from Washington. Medea is a legendary activist and the co-founder of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
At least 10 people were killed during demonstrations in Nicaragua this weekend over the issue of pension reforms amidst criticisms of the country's economy raised by the International Monetary Fund. Why would a progressive government like Nicaragua's bend to IMF pressure? We are joined from Huigalpa, Nicaragua by Nils McCune. He's a member of La Via Campesina, the International Peasants Movement, and he would like to make clear that he is speaking on his own behalf rather than for the entire organization. Nils, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
This question really is the operative question. Why would a progressive government like Nicaragua's bend to the IMF when the IMF has caused so much grief in so many other countries around the world?
Yeah, I think that was exactly the question. And that's why, in this case, the Nicaraguan government did not take the IMF option. So a couple of weeks ago, you know, it's been since last year that the IMF has said that there needs to be deep reforms in the pension system in Nicaragua. And let's see, about 2 weeks ago, the IMF presented sort of an ultimatum to the Nicaraguan government saying you need to raise the age of retirement and you need to add to the number of weeks that people pay into the system in order to reach their pension fund. And the Nicaraguan government proposed something else, which was leave the retirement age where it is, leave the number of weeks that people have to pay into the pension system where it is, and increase the amount that both people, the government, and employers pay into the system. So the proposed increase was 0.75% for workers. It was 1.5% for the government, and it was 2% for employers. And that was when the business lobby called for protests.
So what do you think we should expect to see in the coming days and weeks in Nicaragua as the government tries to come to some sort of a policy on this issue? They have to keep the Nicaraguan people happy, and at the same time, they have to keep their creditors and the banks happy too.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a very small amount of negotiation room with regard to the pension fund issue. And then there's the broader context, which is that what's happening in the streets has very little to do with the pension fund at this point. This is part of a larger destabilization effort, I'd say. So in the, with the funding itself of the pension funds, there's a couple of possibilities. The business lobby has called for they'll say they'll pay the 2% more into the INS, which is the Social Security program here, if they're given a 2% relief on taxes. So the government has said, well, we need to negotiate one and then negotiate the other. And as for people, well, obviously, when people are told that they're going to be paying more for their pension fund and for healthcare, they tend to see that as an austerity measure. In this case, it's hard to see it as a decision by the government to not be submissive to the IMF, which is the way that I see it. So it's a tricky situation. There is a deep desire on the part of the Nicaraguan people to end the violence. I'd say there's 95% of the Nicaraguan population wants there to be no more deaths, no more people hurting each other in the street. And there's probably 5% which is exuberant and sees this as a strategy for regime change along the lines of the Arab Spring and the destabilization efforts in Venezuela.
When you think about the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, that was one of the three pillars created by the United States as it constructed a post-World War II order. There was, of course, the United Nations, which the U.S. would assume that it would be the leader of, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. And the fourth component was the Bretton Woods Agreement that allowed the U.S. dollar to become the currency of the world, giving the U.S. this privileged position to be able to be the only government in the world that could print the world currency, actually just print it. Now you have the IMF imposing these demands really on Nicaragua, a country of 6 million people. But if you look at other news of the day, the IMF is also demanding that China, the People's Republic of China, 1.3 billion people, also has to enact reforms. You have it imposing pension reforms on Tunisia.
That's right. On Greece, on Yemen, on Argentina. It happens all over the world.
And they use euphemistic language like we want to help pro-growth policies. But this is really the bankers asking the governments of different countries, especially in the emerging and developing world, to sacrifice their people's living standards, like pensions, for instance, so that money can be used as collateral, in essence, to finance debt paid for or given, provided by either the IMF or IMF-friendly Western capitalist banks. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's why the banking sector is where all the wealth gains of the last 20 years have gone.
So what's a country like Nicaragua to do? Of course, Nicaragua is trying to find short-term fixes because, of course, a small country that needs access to credit in order to engage in global trade. They have to conform to the rules of the road, and the rules of the road are created by institutions like the IMF or like the big banking monopolies, either in New York or London or Paris. What can be done? And what's Nicaragua trying to do? Of course, we had the ALBA project earlier, where countries in Latin America were trying to cooperate with each other to be semi-independent from some of these institutions. What's Nicaragua's perspective?
Yeah, I think Nicaragua has been hard hit by the lack of Venezuelan funds in the economy in recent years. And so they're stuck with a hostile world situation. And, you know, the Nicaraguan model, which appeared to be so strong just a few weeks ago, has been based on consensus. So it's been based on a weekly meeting between the government and business officials to try to understand how to negotiate solutions to all kinds of problems. And this is a rare case where the government with labor unions made a decision that wasn't what the IMF wanted. It was a decision that was trying to find a solution without taking pensions away from veterans of war or the elders. It was a solution to keep the pension system public rather than privatizing it. And this is what we have. We have an incredible protest movement that's taken on a life of its own. The issue was one day it was pension fund, the next day it was free speech, and now it's any variety of issues, which all lead to regime change. So from the government's perspective, it's like you take one tiny baby step away from towing the line, and this is what you get. So obviously it's a very difficult situation.
Tell us about that, because the press is not covering that aspect of this here in the States. Is this a potential threat to the stability of the government?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. You have first a question of pension funds, and you're able to get a little protest out of it, which is the same thing that they've tried to do in the past with the anti-canal protests, which is, again, they're legitimate issues that need to be discussed. They need to be talked about. But the idea of turning them into an issue that can destabilize the government is obviously something that we've seen in many other countries at this point. So first, there's the protest, then there's the incident, then there's 10,000 videotape images of the incident, which get promoted across the country using paid publicity on Facebook. And by the next day, there's a real protest movement because people have seen repression and they don't want to see it. So whether that repression was real or not gets lost in the medley of people starting to insult each other on Facebook and the country becoming polarized. Everybody who I know has lost many friendships over the last couple of days as people have become deeply polarized. Many think that this is pure manipulation. Others think that there is some manipulation happening, but there's some legitimate complaints as well. But what's clear is that this is no longer about the system of pension funds, and it's much more about whether or not this movement can force the resignation of President Daniel Ortega.
Right.
You know, when we think back to the history of CIA destabilization campaigns, they frequently go along with creating economic chaos.
Absolutely.
You saw that in Chile, of course, between 1970 and 73, when the U.S. wanted to overthrow the socialist government of Allende. The government of Mohamed Mossack Dey that was overthrown in by the CIA and British intelligence in 1953, that was preceded by a period of economic destabilization, whereby parts of the middle class sort of blamed the democratically elected government, and then the U.S. or U.S. CIA or British intelligence were able to take advantage of it. It's a John Kiriakou, you know, I mean, this is a tried and true destabilization strategy.
It is, and it continues. Now, here we are in the 21st century. It continues because it works. I mean, the first thing you do when you want to overthrow a government is you destabilize its economy. It invites chaos, and it makes your job easier.
All in the name of pension reform. Anyway, John, we're completely out of time.
We were joined from Huigalpa, Nicaragua by Nils McCune. He's a member of La Via Campesina, the International Peasants Movement. He wanted to make clear that he was speaking on his own behalf rather than for the entire organization. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education around the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He is an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. Bill Ayers, welcome back to the show.
Nice to hear your voice.
Same here. We're always glad to have you. We wanted to start today with this new Arizona teacher strike. It's being reported in all the major papers today that Arizona teachers statewide are planning to strike later this week, probably on Thursday. This is another in a long line of statewide teacher strikes that we've seen just over the last 4 or 5 weeks. What are the issues that teachers in Arizona are facing? Why are they striking?
Well, you know, I've said this to you before, but I think what we're witnessing is a social movement that has implications as a labor management conflict, but it really is a social movement fighting for public education. What's brilliant about what's going on in Arizona, and of course, it's inspired by West Virginia, Kentucky, and to go deeper, it's inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement, by the Women's March, and the general sense of a resistance coalescing to the kind of rise of fascism and the continuation of neoliberalism. But what's great about Arizona is they're saying the governor is saying, we'll give you a 20% raise over the next couple of years. And the teachers are saying, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Arizona and these other states deserting the concept of public education, leaving people in the lurch. And so if you give us a 20% raise and you leave the schools in a wreck and you continue to wreck the rest of public service, then what good is it? Because we will be scapegoated, we will be targeted, and that's not what we're fighting for. Yes, we need a raise. We've been cheated and exploited and oppressed. We need that raise, but we're not taking the raise without a commitment to revitalizing and reimagining public education in Arizona.
Yeah, I agree. This really is a movement, Brian. We saw it start in West Virginia. It went to Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Kentucky, now Arizona. And these are really not states that have traditions of strong teachers unions. I think we've gotten to this tipping point where teachers just can't take anymore. And the only option that they have left to them is to strike.
Yeah. And Bill Ayers, you are a chronicler of social movements and how they emerge. And you know, when we look back at history, we think of big events, sort of like the March on Washington in 1963 or Rosa Parks not giving up her seat to a white man in Montgomery, all kinds of sort of focus on moments. But really, when movements happen, there are, you know, subterranean forces at play, and then progress begins, and there's incremental steps, and there's victories, and there are defeats. But the thing that makes it clear that it's a movement is that it's sustained, and it's sustained actually and almost always by the, you know, sort of unrecognized efforts of rank and file or, quote, average people who suddenly become actors in the political, on the political stage. It seems to me like, and again, a lot of times it starts where you least likely to jump out. It seems to me that we're right there now.
I couldn't agree more. I think that big events are what we kind of what history gives us, or that's what kind of journalism highlights. But the reality is, the day before any revolution, whether it's Rosa Parks or the Paris Commune, the day before it seems impossible. The day after it looks inevitable. But let's take the question of big moments versus something bubbling from below. It's not just organizing and activism that's bubbling. It's the contradiction that's irresolvable between capital and labor, between imperialism and liberation. So these things are bubbling. Take the question of Black Power, which Stokely Carmichael announced to the world in the Meredith March in Mississippi. That was bubbling below the surface for years, and it burst out, and then it became a big thing where, you know, kind of the white media got a hold of it and made a thing of it. But the reality is it was moving forward for a long time because, precisely because, the Black Freedom Movement had reached its goals in terms of voting rights, in terms of national legislation, but it had not reached its goal concerning justice or liberation. That Black Power movement was the next obvious step when you look back. And that's true of Rosa Parks, too. Many, many, many people sat in on buses. There was something bubbling. There was organizing happening. The contradiction between apartheid in the South and kind of the juggernaut of capitalism moving forward was too great, and eventually it burst forward. So I agree with you completely. I would say also that why it's a movement is not just that it's sustained, it's that people are reframing the issues before us in profound ways and connecting the issues. So we see the teachers in Arizona connecting women's struggles with the idea of a public sector, with the idea of labor rights. These aren't separate. They're being connected. And I think that's one of the most exciting things I've seen in many, many years.
I think Bill is exactly right. It's easy to say teachers are going on strike in different states because the pay is low, they're out of pocket on classroom supplies, et cetera, et cetera. But it's far, far deeper than that. This really is a national movement. This cuts to the very heart of the nature of public education. You have somebody who is in place as Secretary of Education that's actually hostile to public education. And so you can only push people so far.
You're absolutely right. And the governors of these states are also hostile to public education. They mock teachers. They make fun of them. I think the governor of Arizona is the one who said, who shook his car keys and said, "Oh, these are like spoiled teenagers wanting the car." And the teachers all showed up shaking their car keys at the demonstration with a banner that said, "Damn those rich teachers and their 98 Camaros." You know, I mean, they're mocking them back, and they're saying, they're standing up for something very profound. Notice also that in Kentucky, the teachers from West Virginia came out to address the rallies. And in Arizona, they're calling on the teachers in the earlier states to come. And notably, every one of these states is a right to work state, or what we call a right to work for less state. It's now swept up to Colorado, a blue state, but nonetheless a right to work for less state. This is really significant.
Bill Ayers is our guest. Bill is an award-winning educator. He's devoted his entire life to innovation in education, to supporting and helping students, helping their parents, helping communities. He's also a longtime anti-war activist. Bill, you know, in our last couple of minutes, I want to turn to another question. It's a historical issue. And it speaks, again, though, to what you were saying. It's not, a movement isn't just people taking action, and it's not simply that it's enduring. There's a reframing of issues by the participants. And as people engage in struggle and engage in activity, their consciousness changes, and that consciousness then reframes. Today, this very day, is the 50th anniversary of when the Columbia students, a very privileged Ivy League school, under the leadership of SDS and other radicals, seized Hamilton Hall in a student protest that actually, in big ways, reframed the, quote, student movement and the anti-war movement in the United States. You were a member, a leader of the SDS. Talk about this day in history.
Yes, it was 50 years ago today that students seized Hamilton Hall, the main classroom at Columbia University, an elite private school in New York City. And it was an extraordinary event. But what really is important is it wasn't, even though history says it was led by Students for a Democratic Society, anyone who was there knows that the real leadership came from the Student Afro-American Society, and they were linked to the people of Harlem. There were two demands that were non-negotiable. One was Columbia had to break ties with the IDA, with the war machine, and two, Columbia had to cease their plans to build a gigantic gymnasium in a city park above Harlem and reinforce the apartheid of the city. And what the residents of Harlem did is they mobilized, organized, and fought that gymnasium. It was called, by the way, Jim Crow, G-Y-M Crow, because it was a perfect example of this elite university participating in Jim Crow, even though it had the kind of air of liberal tolerance and so on. So I think it's really a significant thing. But the most significant thing is that the students seized Hamilton Hall, black and white, and then the black students said, you know what, you white folks have to go find your own space. There again, you see a struggle on campus being impacted by what was going on in the world. The black freedom movement was taking a turn toward black power. Stokely Carmichael, one of the leaders, H. Rapp Brown, one of the leaders, visited the black students in Hamilton Hall over the next several days while the occupation went on. And eventually, this elite university called in the cops, arrested hundreds and hundreds of students, bloodied them, and it became a national crisis. So the students, led by the black students, who were themselves led by the black community, went toe-to-toe with Mayor Lindsay, with the New York City cops, with the elite establishment of Columbia University, and they won. Columbia did have to break ties with the IDA. They did have to cease building the gymnasium. And that became a template for what was to follow over the next several years. Not just the militancy, which is what's remembered, but the sense that black students had a key to the struggle that white students could learn from and grow from in unity, in alliance, in allyship.
Excellent. Unfortunately, as we say every single week at the end of this session, we're out of time. You know, I wish we could continue these conversations on for hours, really. They're so interesting to me.
Well, you can come back next Monday and we'll do it again with Bill Ayers, That's Education right. for Liberation.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Michael Pompeo is currently the CIA director. His nomination to be Secretary of State will come to a vote this afternoon in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He will likely not receive a favorable vote, but he still has a path to victory on the floor of the U.S. Senate. We're joined from Hawaii by Ann Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. Ann, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Always great to have you. So this Pompeo confirmation vote, Ann, it looks like he will not have enough votes to receive a favorable recommendation in committee, in which case he would then need 60 votes on the floor of the U.S. Senate to be confirmed. But the rumor here in Washington is that Mitch McConnell will end some 240 years of Senate precedent by changing the rule using what's called the nuclear option that would make a vote of only 51 senators enough to push Pompeo over the top. First of all, do you think that will happen? And secondly, does it really matter? Is Pompeo going to be any different than Tillerson was or any different than, let's say, Senator Tom Cotton would be? Because he's also rumored to be interested in state.
Well, it's going to be down to the wire for sure. And I wouldn't doubt at all that McConnell is going to use the nuclear option because they definitely want to, the Republicans definitely want to get Pompeo in as Secretary of State. A week and a half ago, I got arrested in the U.S. Senate in the confirmation hearings for challenging the nomination of Pompeo for all the reasons that we know. I mean, he has said racial bigoted things about LGBT folks. He's been a warmonger as a member of Congress. To his credit, though, I mean, it was the day after I got arrested. Then we find out that he had gone all the way to North Korea and actually talked to, you know, the leader of Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, for which I will give him great credit, and probably the only time I'll ever say this, and to Donald Trump for sending him over there. That is a very, very positive step. And to the extent that his candidacy for Secretary of State, I mean, we do need a Secretary of State, and the Republicans are not going to put in any nominees that I think I'm going to be 100% for at all. But we do need to get somebody in there, and we need to get someone who will support the institution rather than allow it to be torn down, which happened under Tillerson. Now, Pompeo, having been in the Congress and having been in the U.S. military, although there's a little bit of a dispute going on right now whether or not he actually served in Gulf War I or just happened to be in the military during that time. A little bit of a change there from the original history he gave. But, you know, he did graduate at the top of his class at West Point. He was top of his class in the Harvard Law Review, or Harvard Law School, and then Harvard Law Review. The man's no dummy, that's for sure. And I would hope that should he be confirmed as Secretary of State, that he would be a person that would try to build back up the capabilities of the State Department, which we definitely are going to need on the issue of North Korea, the issue, impending issue on whether or not the Trump administration is going to deep six the Iran nuclear deal. So we need the right person for sure, but I'm not too sure the Republicans will ever put in a nominee that will be totally satisfactory to me.
Well, let's talk about that, actually, because you raise a very important point here. First of all, I want to read to you something that New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Menendez said during the first day of the Pompeo hearings. It says here that Menendez ticked off contradiction after contradiction. Pompeo said during the hearing that he supports a diplomatic approach to Iran's nuclear program, but in the past he said that regime change was the only way, quote, the only way to deal with the problem. He said that he opposes regime change in North Korea, but had mused just a year ago about toppling the Kim regime. Now he is known to have gone to North Korea to meet with at least with representatives of the Kim regime. The pattern was clear, it says. Pompeo has a long history of extreme rhetoric on issues ranging from the use of military force to Islam to LGBTQ rights, but had spent the entire hearing presenting a much less extreme and more palatable version of his views. That's true. he is a political player. He knows exactly what the committee wants to hear because he sat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and on the House Intelligence Committee. So that's one issue. The other issue is at the CIA, if you ask CIA people, which I have, they say that politics aside, he's actually been a good manager in that he has done all he can to back his people up and to argue their case before the oversight committees. You are exactly right, Anne, that that's really what the State Department needs after it had been decimated by Rex Tillerson and Donald Trump. So do you think that in the event that Pompeo actually wins on the floor of the Senate, that he will work to rebuild the professional diplomatic cadre at the State Department? Or do you think that his ideology, his personal ideology, will be too much for professional diplomats to get past?
Well, right now, I think professional diplomats are just begging for help. And right now, under Tillerson, who was kind of a moderate person in terms of his views, but had no spine to go against the White House when apparently the White House ordered the destruction of the State Department. I would hope that Pompeo would stand up for the State Department. He certainly knows how governmental organizations work, having been in the Congress and having a little bit of a background in the military. And I think, as you mentioned, with the comments you've gotten from CIA people, that he helps the institution. Right now, we need a person who will help the institution of the State Department. When you look at some of the things that have happened under Tillerson, where the rhetoric that now is in the documents that the State Department puts out, having eliminated some of the key phrases that we have, like human rights for all and things like that, now it's a very tainted way the U.S. government, through the State Department, is portraying what we think the world should be. Not to say that Pompeo is going to help too much on that, I'm afraid, because of his history and the comments we already know that he's made. But maybe if he will not preside over the total destruction of the institution, but indeed try to buck it up some, we may be able to get some people who will stand up and say to him, we cannot allow this thing to go on, and the types of rhetoric that you have used in the past can't go on. That's the part that's really tricky. I think he'll stand up for the institution, but I'm afraid with some of the things that he will have put in place will probably mirror a lot what Tillerson stood for or allowed to happen.
I know the Iranian government expects that under Pompeo's leadership and in working with Trump, that the coup de grace will happen, the end of the U.S. participation in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action of the Iran nuclear arms deal, and the thus setting the stage for an escalating confrontation with Iran. I think the Iranian government, and I think others in the Middle East who are not Saudi Arabia and not the government in Tel Aviv, are profoundly worried that Pompeo's, even if he runs the State Department differently, that the policy will be an aggressive policy and set the stage for real confrontation, which, of course, is dangerous not only for people in Iran, but for people in the region and perhaps globally. What's your view on that?
Well, I think we may get a little help from an unexpected source. I mean, how in the world would Kim Jong-un in North Korea ever sign anything with the United States when the United States is saying, we're going to torpedo the agreement that was done under the Obama administration? I have a sneaking suspicion in those North Korean negotiations, the North Koreans are going to tell the U.S., the first time that you start tinkering with that treaty that you've done with Iran, all bets are off for us. We'll just start blowing up nuclear weapons again. I mean, right now, the North Koreans really have a lot of things in their hands that they can use. And I would hope we would get some help from the North Koreans to try to preserve the treaty with Iran. And Angela Merkel yesterday was very firm, saying that there's no way in the world that the Germans are going to back out of that. The United States, if it backs out, what it means is that U.S. corporations that would have been able to go into Iran, into that country that has 80 million people in it. I mean, Iran is a very lucrative market for our commercial interests. And indeed, the Europeans have been making lots of money because of the lifting of some of the sanctions. And I think there are a lot of U.S. businessmen, and they're going to be really mad at the Trump administration if they undercut him.
That's what this comes down to. This comes down to Boeing and whether or not Boeing is happy or companies like Boeing. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're certainly going to come back and talk about this again in the near future. We were joined by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired U.S. Army colonel and the former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became a noted anti-war activist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign was cut short 50 years ago with his assassination, but a new effort aims to carry on this legacy today. To assist that campaign, the Institute for Policy Studies has produced a 123-page report on the state of poverty in America to provide facts and data for the movement. We're joined in studio by the report's co-editor, Sharav Sarkar, with the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about this report. What are the main areas that it goes into?
Dr. King had identified the triplets of evil, which were militarism, poverty, and racism. And to this, we added ecological devastation. And those are the four main themes of the report. And the report goes into these as interconnected themes that really highlight what is holding down people in the country today.
Yeah, and tell us, in the United States, you know, the country that always boasts about being the richest country in the world, you know, poverty is intense here. I mean, there's, you know, vast wealth, of course. You know, there's a tiny elite. There's, you know, three people who have something like over $100 billion combined. But there's millions and millions of people who struggle to get the bare necessities of life.
I think the statistic you're referring to is that there are three people who have as much wealth as the bottom half of the country,
right,
which is terrifying. There are 140 million people who, by the supplemental poverty measure, are either low income or poor, which is a significant portion of the population. It really makes you think about what people are talking about when they view the country as a country of wealth. Obviously, there is enormous wealth in the country, but there's such massive inequality that it has led to a situation where there are large numbers of people who can't afford basic necessities like healthcare or water.
Yeah. I mean, on some of these issues, the U.S. government doesn't even bother to keep statistics, right? So in, you know, Martin Luther King's formulations, the evil triplets, the three evils facing afflicting U.S. society, racism is one of them. The U.S. government doesn't even care about keeping track of how many people police kill, which are, you know, disproportionately Black and Latino every year. On poverty, you know, they do come up with an official count, but the criteria they use to define poverty, I mean, in my opinion, is completely ridiculous. Tell us about how the government calculates poverty and your opinion on that measure.
There's an official poverty measure called the OPM, and the government looks at how many people are below a certain income level. And then secondarily to that, there's something called the supplemental poverty measure, which takes into account taxes and other items. That is a more accurate measure, but still somewhat inadequate in terms of measuring fully the extent of poverty in the U.S.
Yeah, Brian, I mean, the United States can't really truly consider itself a democracy when we live in a society where three people have more wealth than the bottom 50% combined or equal wealth to the bottom 50% combined. I mean, how on earth could a society that extremely unequal truly consider itself a democracy where all the citizens have, you know, an equal say in matters?
Right. Maybe that's not democracy. I mean, we have a democracy where we get to vote every 2 or 4 years. Homeless people have the right to vote. Homeless people over the age of 18, the one thing they don't have is the right to a home. The jobless have a right to vote every 2 or 4 years, but they don't have a right to a job or an income. So there's a formal democracy. Some people might call it a bourgeois democracy. In other words, the freedom of some parts of the population to exploit other parts of the population. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, those are the three people we're talking about. They have the combined assets of $248 billion, according to Forbes magazine. And that is indeed equal to the wealth assets of half the population. So it's a kind of democracy, a democracy really for the very, very rich and for the elites. And they not only have a lot of money, they control the newspapers, they control the basic centers of learning and academia. Their ideas become the ideas of society. In your report, when you take a look at the starkness of the core problems of poverty, that is, people don't have money. They don't have money to pay for food. They don't have money to pay for medicine, or sometimes they're choosing to pay for food or medicine or vice versa. And then you have these three individuals, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. People always wonder, well, why are poor people poor? There's a lot of victimization or demonization of poor people as if they're responsible for poverty. But it seems on its face the reason so many people are poor is a few rich people have all the money.
Yeah, that's correct, Brian. There is a lot of demonization, and there is a lot of myth-making about the poor and the causes of poverty. One thing that Reverend Barber, who is one of the key figures in revitalizing the Poor People's Campaign, likes to say is that being poor is not a sin. Poverty is a sin. And that's really the approach that we take in the report as well. We look to the structures that create poverty rather than looking to individual faults or moral faults, as so many people do in assessing the causes of poverty.
We're talking with Sharav Sarkar. He's the co-editor of a new report that's just been released by the Institute for Policy Studies called The Souls of Poor Folk. It was released as part of the new Poor People's Campaign that's, you know, getting off the ground, beginning to mobilize people, to organize people in the streets. Sharav, let's turn to war, that piece of the triplets that Martin Luther King identified about 50 years ago, a little over 50 years ago. You know, those three rich people and, you know, the people who are a little bit less rich than them, but still, you know, unbelievably, fabulously wealthy and powerful. You know, they exploit not just the people in this country, but people all around the world. And they spend a huge, huge amount of money doing it. Talk about the cost of militarism and that. The connection of that with poverty.
Sure. So the cost of militarism is a little bit hard to measure because it's so vast. We know that from the federal discretionary budget, there's over $600 billion that gets spent on the military each year. And that dwarfs the amount of money that's spent on programs for the poor in the United States. But connected to that are all of the lives that are lost around the world, the sexual assaults that take place on military bases, the violence that gets perpetrated in poor and black communities in the United States and elsewhere around the world. So it's hard to measure the vastness of the cost of militarism altogether. But in sheer numerical terms, we can see that budgetarily, the military takes up a vast proportion of the discretionary budget of the United States.
Let's talk a second about Martin Luther King Jr., because he's now an icon. We celebrate his birthday every year. That's important. But what people don't know is that Dr. King was actually a socialist. He was fighting for economic equality. He was fighting for the poor. He was fighting for working class people. He characterized himself in his letters, or even his early letters to his wife-to-be, Coretta Scott King, as a socialist, as a democratic socialist. And this is part of the legacy, the radical legacy of Dr. King that's left out. It reminds me of that famous quote from the Archbishop, the Brazilian Archbishop Helder Camara. He said, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why are they poor, they call me a communist, which I think is a perfect quote. We want to remember Dr. King as a saint, but not as the radical Dr. King. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there is a tendency to sanctify Dr. King and really remove the substance of what he was talking about and the substance of what he was trying to do through his political activities from what we remember about him. There is a tendency to ignore campaigns like the Poor People's Campaign and instead focus on exclusively the symbolic weight of what Dr. King represents today. And it's a mistake. And I think that one of the aims that we have in releasing this report and in collaborating with the Poor People's Campaign is to rectify that and to really bring attention to the issues that poor people are raising up today. You know, this report is It's the product of a lot of research, but it's also the product of engaging with tens of thousands of people that the Poor People's Campaign through the Cairo Center and Repairers of the Breach, the two main organizations that head up the Poor People's Campaign, have engaged in over the last few years. And it's really hearing those voices that reflects the best of what Dr. King stood for and what Dr. King's allies stood for. The Poor People's Campaign was a campaign of many, many people, and it was a multiracial campaign in the late 60s. And so that's what is being attempted to be reincarnated today.
Yeah, and how do people get the report before we leave?
Sure. The report is available at ips-dc.org. The Institute for Policy Studies website.
Yeah, the report's called The Souls of Poor Folk, which of course is an allusion to the seminal work by W.E.B. Du Bois, another fighter against racism, against poverty and war. We've been joined in studio by the co-editor of that report, Sharav Sarkar. He's with the Institute for Policy Studies.
We're completely out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Loud Clear Radio on Twitter. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Love.